Goodbye, ladies and gentlemen, friends and truth seekers, all you dissidents out there sick and tired of our lying governments, the bankers that pull their strings, and the corporate Marxist internationalists that are executing their orders. Thank you for tuning in today. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and it is nice to be able to speak to you once again. If you're new to the program, the best place to go is redicecreations.com, where you can listen to more radio, see our videos, and read our regular news updates. We have a lot for you there. Today we're speaking with the publisher and editor of radicalpress.com, Arthur Topham, about the dire situation when it comes to freedom of speech and freedom of press in Canada. Arthur has been running the website since June of 1998. He was a graduate of Simon Fraser University. He majored in political science and education. He was a schoolteacher for 6 years, and he has also been a carpenter, log home builder, park warden, and a writer and journalist. As you might know, we don't always agree with all our guests, but we think it's very important that you get a chance to hear the stories like those of Arthur so that you can get a better grasp on how things really are like for those people challenging the system, how our governments treat those that hold a different view on history and have done their own research and have come to their own conclusions. It demonstrates how these societies excludes and throws you out while they claim they are open, tolerant, and democratic, when this clearly is not the case. We'll talk about his story today and some of the current issues with Canada's political system and who is pulling the strings. Welcome, Arthur Topham. Thank you so much for coming on the program today. Really appreciate your time. We know how busy you are, and we know how much you have to deal with over there in Canada. So thank you for coming on, Arthur. Hope you're doing well today.
Thank you so much, Henrik, for having me on your program. I'm doing well, and I'm looking forward to discussing the issues.
Definitely. Now, we'll want to speak quite regularly with people that end up in the crosshairs of the establishment for various reasons, and try to bring attention to how the big hand of the state does what it likes unchecked in some cases, specifically concerning people who, dare to speak their mind and tell it like they see it and not be deterred by either political correctness or other activities that leads to self-censorship that today I would say probably is the biggest threat to freedom of speech and freedom of thought even. But you've been involved in a court case for many, many years now. You've been publishing at radicalpress.com. Why don't you just kind of tell us your story a bit, Arthur, and how this case has unfolded for you? I know it's a long one. I know you've gone over that in some detail as well before, but for our audience that might not be aware of your case, give us an overview of what has happened here, Arthur.
Well, I started an alternative newspaper back in 1998 when the alternative press was not that popular or that large during that period of time, and the internet was just getting started. So I opted for a hard copy edition of a actual monthly 24-page tabloid that I started putting out called The Radical. It was published here in British Columbia, Canada. And I put out 42 editions of it over a period of about 4 years. And at the end of that, I was already in court over some issues exposing some corruption within the provincial government. When that was concluded, I decided to take the publication online. I wasn't able to afford to fund it any longer because it's much more expensive to do hard copy editions and so on and so forth. So I switched to online, and then I have been basically running Radical Press now for going on, it'll soon be 16 years. And of course, it's an evolutionary process when you start to cover issues. I called my newspaper originally The Radical, and I based it on that word radical, which has been so abused, by the mainstream media and elsewhere throughout history, actually. It actually comes from a Latin word, radix, R-A-D-I-X, which means digging to the root of an issue. And that was basically what I wanted to do with my first publication and with my website, was to dig to the root of the issues that were of concern to people, either on all levels, government or whatever else. And so I followed suit with that. And of course, myself, at the time I started it, I was in my early 50s, and I had spent many years prior to that, you know, writing on political issues and so on. I actually started, I think I wrote my first letter to the editor back in 1968 protesting issues to do with the Vietnam War. And so I have a fairly long history of being, you know, interested in political issues, be they local, you know, or nationalistic or global, whatever the case might have been. So I continued in my researches and studies and so on, covering the issues of the day. And of course, I wasn't in business that long, you know, before 9/11 struck in September of 2001. You know, and that was basically an event that, you know, dramatically changed the world situation, you know, for, and has been affecting us ever since.
Oh, yeah.
And so I started delving into all the various issues around that, and eventually I started studying the whole Middle East question. I had been aware of what was going on in the Middle East for years. I had read a lot of material on it and so forth back in the 80s and 90s even, but I always kind of avoided it because there was something wrong in the overall picture I was getting. I wasn't getting the information that clarified what was really going on there. And of course, later on, I realized that most of the information that I was, you know, the sources I was going to and so on, you know, were sources that, you know, were directly or indirectly, you know, a part of the problem in the first place. And that eventually, you know, like all roads that once led to Rome, it turned out that all roads nowadays lead to Tel Aviv, more or less.
Right.
And then I eventually got on to, you know, the whole issue of political Zionism and what was going on in the Israeli-Palestine issue and so forth. And I started to report more and more on those issues. And that was the beginning of my confrontations with the Jewish lobby groups here in Canada. And basically they have had for years here kind of a hidden radar system that they scan everybody's websites and so on in Canada, looking for any indication of, you know, somebody criticizing either the state of Israel and the actions of the government, or else criticizing anything to do with the Israeli ideology or political ideology that we all know now as Zionism. And eventually, in the fall of 2007, I suddenly received a large white envelope in my mailbox that came from the Canadian Human Rights Commission, which is a federal quasi-judicial organization that supposedly defends the, you know, the human rights of Canadian citizens if they're caught up in various scenarios, you know, for example, you know, they're having problems with employment and stuff like that. Those were used to be the main issues that it dealt with, and certain types of discrimination and so on.
Right.
But they eventually decided to go into the hate crime business, and that's how they ended up coming after me, because an organization here in Canada called B'nai B'rith Canada, which basically is an offshoot of B'nai B'rith International, which is a global organization that was originally formed by the Rothschilds back in the middle of the 19th century, It's also a Masonic Jews-only organization, although most people in the world don't realize that. That group here in Canada decided that they didn't like some of my articles that I had posted on my website. I was posting various writers at the time who were current in the alternative news business. And so they sent me this large form and so on and so forth, saying that I had been, a complaint had been laid against me by the Canadian, or by the B'nai B'rith Canada, alleging, and basically what it said was that I was promoting hatred affecting persons identifiable as Jews and or as citizens of Israel. And at the time I thought, well, first of all, I was obviously shocked to begin with, to a certain degree, that I received it based on the content that I had on my website. But I was kind of especially surprised by the fact that a Canadian organization like that would be trying to charge me with a hate crime for criticizing citizens of Israel, which at the time was actually a novel charge, and I believe the first charge of its kind that was laid against a Canadian citizen. Huh. And it was an example of the beginning of the whole hate crime legislation period here in Canada, where they were slowly starting to work around and introduce these types of draconian laws into our judiciary and so on, in order to prohibit people from either criticizing Israeli policies or anything to do with Zionism itself. So that was the beginning. It was on November 20th, 2007 that I received that notification from the Canadian Human Rights Commission, and that basically put me into the whole legal or quasi-judicial system that was set up in place. They also have a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal that goes along with it, and the first group decides that you're guilty, and then the second group runs you through the gamut of all kinds of excruciating tortures until they finally find you guilty, and they either there was no jail sentences involved with that particular complaint or crime, that hate crime, but they could end up taking down your website and putting a cease and desist order on you so that you would never be able to publish anything anymore on the web, anything to do with the issues, to do with what the charge revolved around, type of thing. Hmm. So it became an ongoing process, and I went through it right up until about 2009, when there was another case ahead of me, one involving a fellow called Mark Lemire from out in Ontario, and he'd been charged basically under the same provision. It's called Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act that they were using. And they had slipped that section in, actually, right after 2001, when the U.S. brought in all their Homeland Security legislation and so on.
Right.
I think it was in December of 2001 that Canada enacted their Anti-Terrorism Act, and it was went through. It almost went through, in a similar manner to how they pulled off the Banking Act in 1913 when they created the Federal Reserve.
Right.
It was like,
yeah,
right before Christmas and everybody was leaving, kind of thing. And it was one thing or another. They suddenly decided, and this was through the influence of the Jewish lobbies here, they decided they were going to slip in this provision of Section 13(1) into the Anti-Terrorism Act. And in doing so, it then made it illegal or breaking the law, you know, to criticize people like the Zionist Jews. You know, that was if it was done on the internet, you know, so it brought, it raised the whole level of seriousness of the so-called crime up to and on to the internet, which changed it, you know, completely, and that's basically what their intent was, and they were using it ever since. And anyways, the case was stayed. My case was stayed eventually in 2010, pending the outcome of this other case that was ahead of me, and eventually in June 25th of 2012. The federal government finally repealed that particular provision in the Canadian Human Rights Act and put an end to that, and that put an end basically to that charge against me. And that should have been the end of my trials and tribulations with the whole issue. But of course, being relentless as they are, the Jewish lobby knew what was coming down the track. And they decided that they would use a provision within the Canadian Criminal Code. We have what's known as Section 318 to 320 in the Canadian Criminal Code, and those are specific laws concerned with quote-unquote hate propaganda. They're basically the same as what the Section 13 was in the Human Rights Act.
Right.
But.
Yeah.
But the provisions are the same there, and so prior, even prior to the repeal of the Section 13, this same organization, B'nai B'rith Canada, and another flunky lawyer who'd been taking advantage of that system. I can't mention either one of their names because I have a court order issued against me where I can't publish the names of these two individuals who've been harassing me for a number of years, but one is a representative of B'nai B'rith Canada, and they then registered complaints with the RCMP here in British Columbia, and charged me under Section 319(2) of the Canadian Criminal Code, and that section basically states the same thing, you know, promoting hatred towards an identifiable group, and in this case, again, people of, you know, Jewish origins or religion or ethnicity. But in this last case, they dropped the Citizens of Israel bit that they had on the other one, and I've been now dealing with this. That's the current charge that I'm now facing, that I've been dealing with since May 16th of 2012, when I was arrested and thrown in jail and charged with that particular so-called hate crime.
So you were arrested in 2012, yet despite that, it's been going on for a really long time. How many years is it now, Arthur?
It's been, I don't have the figures in front of me here. I had it worked out in right up to the days, but it's going on 8 years. You know, wow. that this harassment, you know, from the lobby has been going on.
Well, it's amazing, you know, what they can get away with when it comes to, for example, how they're treating, you know, the Palestinians, and you know, frankly, they can drop bombs on people, but you can't write your opinions about those who drop those bombs. I mean, it's really one of those cases to, you know, to learn who rules over you, simply find out you're not allowed to criticize, as Voltaire so, you know, elegantly put it. But so what was so dangerous about, you know, what you were writing? I mean, in some cases you didn't, as you said, you didn't even write it yourself. These were, you know, published of other authors in some cases. Maybe there were other personal opinions of yours in there, but it's a blog basically, right? And you, was anything what you were writing promoting violence or hatred towards anybody, or why were you targeted, do you think?
Well, no, nothing that I publish on radicalpress.com promotes violence. Of course, when we come to that term hatred, then we're dealing with, I suppose you could say that the Zionist Jews hate any criticism and consider any negative comments made about the state of Israel or their behavior as a form of hatred, and that is why they spent and so many years in preparing the so-called hate crimes legislation that surreptitiously slipped into, you know, the jurisprudence of, you know, Canadian law. You see the same thing in Australia. You see it in Germany. You see it in other European countries. And, of course, they would love to have it in the United States as well, too. But the founding fathers there, fortunately, did an end run around that, by providing them with, specific constitutional rights guaranteeing them, freedom of speech, which we theoretically we have that in our, charter of rights freedoms here. But of course, there's always the little caveat, they can change that depending on what it might be, and that's how they've gotten around this provision in the criminal code,
mm-hmm.
Where they still turn around and charge people with so-called hate crimes, even though no one has advocated any violence, and there's no particular individual victim involved,
Right.
And that's, I think that's a big part of the of the overall equation, and what makes these laws so kind of despicable is that they're, an individual isn't being kind of pinpointed and that sort of thing. It's just people are criticizing the actions of countries and nations and politicians in general, these types of things, which I feel that anyways as a Canadian citizen, I have a right and I have a duty. If I see things happening in my country that I feel are detrimental to the democratic principles that I've been raised up to, to hold dear to my heart, it's my duty to inform others about what's going on, and
right.
And that's the whole reason why I began to, focus more and more on the whole issue of the Zionist lobby here in Canada, because it was, once you start looking into it, it doesn't take too long before you realize just the depth of their permeation of just about every level of Canadian society, whether it's within the judiciary itself, or within the media, or within academia, it's there at basically all levels, and unless the Canadian public becomes aware of it, they're never going to figure out what's going on and why Canada has been suddenly shifted, from being what we were once considered a peacekeeping country. Now we're basically behaving, exactly the way that the state of Israel is, and Harper's dragging us into a scenario here where, a lot of people are losing a lot of respect for a country that I, still maintain, can turn things around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And it's very, we've been keeping stressing this particular point, but what's so dangerous about this is that once they begin to, snip in one of the ends of the spectrums of what's, acceptable in their view of politics or voicing opinions or whatnot, you're on a dangerous path when you begin to, because there might be some people that are like, oh, well, that's okay, because we don't want any of that, right? But then, they can go to the other side of that spectrum. This will diminish anything that has to do with freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of the press and everything else. And that's really what this is about. And I think even those who might be your detractors, Arthur, should recognize that it's not the business of government to come in a situation like this and tell you what you can't or can't write. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, totally. It's not their business whatsoever. Their business, if anything, should be to support the type of legislation that allows for the citizens to be able to freely express their opinions and their ideas on how they perceive the country and the government and how it's being run, and whether it's being run in the best interests of the population itself, or whether it's being threatened by vested interests. And that is precisely what's happening to Canada right now, is that vested interests here in Canada, i.e. the Jewish lobbyists who are working, you know, directly with, you know, the Israeli state, are hell-bent on changing Canada's foreign policies and Canada's whole commitment to peace and Canada's whole commitment to actually to truth and justice. They're turning it upside down. You know, they've got a puppet prime minister in there right now, willing to do and say whatever he's told, you know, and pledge his obeisance to the state of Israel, and basically doesn't give a damn about Canada itself and our former reputation and our basic you know, democratic principles, you know, that we've lived by for centuries here now.
Yep, definitely. Now, a little bit later, I want to ask you more about what actually more recently has happened in, you know, Canada when it comes to the shootings and all that, too, and how they're seeking to change things there. The Ottawa shooting of the two, you know, armed forces soldiers, basically. But we'll get to that later. But let's zoom out a little bit more and talk about the big picture here in terms of why they're seeking to enforce this. Because, I mean, you're absolutely right. They're doing this in, you know, a lot of different countries and whatnot. But what is this designed to do? Why is it that they are so incapable of dealing with any kind of criticism that's targeting them? But to me, it's kind of a indication that, to a certain extent, they're actually worried about, you know, the power of the internet and how much that has managed to spread a lot of information, a lot of this critique and everything else. And it's a way for them to try to begin to control what's being written about on the web. Or is there more to it than that, Arthur?
Well, Henrik, I've always maintained, and I'm not the only one who says this, you know, that the internet was basically the Achilles heel for the whole Zionist agenda for global hegemony, which has been ongoing now at least, you know, since the end of the 19th century. The whole 20th century was theirs, basically, in terms of having control of the content of information that the majority of people in the world were getting, especially, you know, in the West. And they owned basically all forms of media. They owned Hollywood. They owned, here in North America, all the magazines, the newspapers, the television stations, you name it. They called the shots in terms of propaganda, in terms of telling people what history was according to them, and they were quite happy with that, and for obvious reasons, because you know, they're a very patient, persevering lot, as those who've studied their modus operandi realize. They're more than willing to take decades or even centuries to achieve certain aims if they want, because it's an ongoing process. So when the internet finally came around and people suddenly started expressing their opinions, opinions that never would have reached any sizable amount of readership anywhere, suddenly people were starting to publish stuff that just flew in the face of what the majority of the populations of the West had been told. And I'm speaking about fundamental issues like, you know, dealing with, you know, for example, the First World War and the Second World War and the causes of these things.
Yeah.
And of course, the number one linchpin that holds the whole Zionist boat together, the issue of the 6 million Holocaust, these types of things, all of those things, you know, I'm not sure, Henrik, how old you are, whether you're in your 50s or 60s.
Not at all. About half of that. Now I'm about 35 now, so.
Okay. So the reason I say that is because, you know, I was born in a couple of years after the end of the Second World War, and throughout all of my early childhood and my adolescence and my education years throughout the 60s and so on, the whole story that I was given by the media and by my history books and teachers and by academia when I went through university and so on, it was basically a Zionist perspective of history, totally unbeknownst to myself, and totally, I believe, unbeknownst to probably 99.9% of the population. We just accepted it as being, you know, that was reality type of thing. And then, of course, when the internet came along in the 90s and little bits of information started to leak out, I think that was when the Zionists realized that they had a problem on their hands. You know, although even before that, especially here in Canada, and maybe we'll talk about that later on at some point here, but, you know, this issue of putting legal precedence into Canadian jurisprudence that would prevent people. See, I think a lot of the reason that they put these so-called hate propaganda legislations in place, and they were put in place in most cases prior to the internet, but they were put there, you know, to prevent people just from publishing, you know, newspapers and articles and stuff like that, you know. But of course, when the internet came along, then they quickly turned around and adapted it to the internet because they could see right away that, like I say, they had a problem on their hands because people were suddenly starting to question some of these long-standing myths that we all took for absolute truth. And it's just been, you know, over the last 20 years or so, there's just been an explosion. You know, there was back in the 60s, Marshall McLuhan's writings, you know, talked about kind of an explosion in information and all of this type of thing. But another explosion took place, I think, in the 90s with the advent of the internet. It's never going to end as far as I can see, unless the whole world comes to an end.
Yeah, well, exactly. You're right. I mean, so, you know, you've had a desire to learn and to study and wanting to know, and specifically then trying to get yourself outside of the paradigm, the bubble of propaganda that we've been fed, and wanting to know, first of all, I'd say the other story, but then ultimately the truth about, you know, these historical matters and how it shapes our world today and the consequences of this and everything, right? But the issue here then seems to be that's a problem. That's now deemed to be, you know, criminal to wanting, to having that desire to find out, right? And that's what it's about. And also this aspect that you're saying that they're seeking to put a precedence into Canadian law here. Is that what they're seeking to do with your case? Or did you say that there were a couple before you that they're dealing with to do this?
No, they haven't. They don't have a precedent as of yet in terms of a conviction under Section 319(2) that is applicable to a case like mine. And this is basically why it's why I consider it, and why many other people as well consider it an important criminal case, because should they get a conviction out of this based on the flimsy evidence that they've so far introduced, you know, I'll give you some examples. You know, I have posted on my website, you know, an online version of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which I'm sure you're well familiar with.
Sure. Yeah.
And that book is available, you know, on probably hundreds of websites around the world. The book itself is sold in Amazon bookstores and other bookstores around the world, type of thing. Yet, the Jewish lobby seems to think that they can use that as an example in a criminal court here in Canada to prove that somehow I am intentionally promoting hatred towards, you know, Jews of ethnic or religious origin simply by having that online book available on my website. You know, that's the type of information, you know, that they're using. I mean, and like I say, there's no specific articles even that I've written over the last 15 years that they've actually made note of, you know, in the charges. They're using something like that. I wrote, and I can't really say I wrote it, I did a satire on a book that was written back in 1941 by a Jew in the United States by the name of Kaufman, who was trying to promote, you know, anti-German hate propaganda in order to get the U.S. into the Second World War.
Yep.
And he wrote a book called The
Germany Must Perish.
Yes, Germany Must Perish. I was just looking at it here on my shelf, you know. And probably the most despicable and grotesque piece of hate literature that I've ever come across in my life. I, you know, a friend of mine gave me a copy of it a couple of years ago, and I read it through, and I was just devastated that something like that actually could have been published, you know, in earnest, you know, and after looking it through and everything, I thought, you know, everything in this book doesn't apply to Germany. This whole thing applies to Israel and to the Zionists. It just suddenly struck me as that. So I thought, well, I'll just do a parody on this thing, and I did it, and I called it, instead of Germany Must Perish, I called it Israel Must Perish.
Right.
You know, and I kind of put it on the website and did a Photoshop front cover. It looked like I had written this book and so on, and all it was a satire, you know. And then when I published it, that was when the B'nai B'rith decided that they had sufficient evidence to warrant filing a complaint, you know, under the Criminal Code of Canada to try to get me into court and charged with this so-called hate crime that they're trying to get away with. And of course, there's nothing, the whole parody that I actually did, I didn't change a word of it. It was all the same text that was in the original book. All I did was basically take the names of the main characters, and wherever the Kaufman had used the word Hitler, I changed it to Netanyahu, and wherever he used the word German or Nazi, I changed it to Jew or Zionist, and that was all I did. Yet they could not, you know, the arresting officer when he was letting me or interviewing me in jail, you know, he was feigning this shock that I would have written such a horrible book about the Jews, and that it was obvious I wanted to genocide the whole Jewish population and this type of thing. And I looked at him like, are you serious? You know, and I later found out that he supposedly was a history major at university as well too, and he had no idea what a satire even was, and couldn't wrap his mind around the fact that, you know. And those are the kinds of things. So I still have all this material on my website. I haven't had to remove it because I'm still able to publish and so on until the trial is over. But I also have another online publication there by an American writer, Phyllis Dilling, who wrote a book where she did a very in-depth critique of the Babylonian Talmud, a well-written book, and that was another example that they felt was proof, you know, that I was promoting hatred towards, you know, Jewish citizens, or I should say people of Jewish ethnicity type of thing. Those are the kinds of things that they're hoping in a court of law will stand up and prove, you know, that I am a promoter of hatred and that my website should be taken down. And furthermore, if they really got, you know, totally got their way, I would end up spending 2 years in jail on top of it, you know.
Right.
And like I say, this is why it's so important that this case be won by myself. Otherwise, if they can use such flimsy evidence, you know, to charge people with these so-called hate crimes, then I don't think there'll be very few critics here in Canada, you know, who are writing on the internet, who will not also be subject to that same sort of draconian behavior.
Well, you know, it's interesting that humor doesn't seem to be part of the legal structure in any way. Maybe we have a famous case in Sweden where the artist Don Park, who now is in jail, due to the fact that he did these very sarcastic and, you know, humorous kind of street art, basically, that was, I mean, largely intended to spark debate and kind of try to prick the bubble that we have in Sweden when it comes to this taboo, you know, around talking about, for example, immigration or talking about these issues, you know, that they've kind of put the lid on. And he did this to kind of, you know, light that flame, basically, you know, and get something going. And humor was actually a large part of it. But that doesn't seem to be part of the legal structure or system in any capacity, that if it's in there, if it's on there, it's that's it, and they take it for face value. So, I mean, what you did there is a great example of discovering a case of if we have double standards or not. I mean, let's put the shoe on the other foot and let's see how people react. I think it's really well done, and it's hilarious. People should laugh at this, but it's sad that they don't, isn't it?
Yes, it is, you know. And speaking of, you know, that particular topic, you know, I have some interesting literature, and some of it, you know, I collect a lot of literature on, you know, on Jewish subjects and themes and so on, and of course my wife comes from a Jewish background herself, and I inherited some books from her parents when they passed away, and one of them was a big thick book called I believe the Book of Jewish Humor, and I sat down, or the Encyclopedia of Jewish Humor, that's what it was, and I sat down one night and I went through that whole book, and you know, it must have been 600-700 pages, and I couldn't find one actual funny joke in the whole thing. You know, I mean, it was as if they kind of lack a sense of humor, you know, and so I can see why maybe they don't appreciate, you know, things like that particular satire that I did on that one book.
Well, maybe it's a cultural issue, Arthur. It's just a lack of understanding
of
the
cultures. I really think it could be, you know, maybe it's just the result of, you know, of living sort of a ghetto existence for 2,000 years, you know, or close to 2,000 years, you know, where humor really didn't play a very major part in their society and their lifestyle or whatever. But yeah, there definitely seems to be a lack of humor on their part, especially when it comes to criticism of some of the actions of the, especially the Zionist aspect of their culture.
Well, I mean, look at Hollywood, though. I mean, we've started to just scrape the surface on detailing this, but there's always a tremendous amount of making fun of, you know, Westerners or Europeans, you know, white people in particular, at least in the modern era now of the entertainment industry that we have. It's just ubiquitous, basically, and it's all fine and dandy, you know, but as soon as we say something, then, there we go again, you know. So it's a case of those double standards there again. But what would you say about the case and where you think this is going to develop and where you think it's going to go? Because what do you see the potential outcome of this is? And tell us about the when upcoming further procedures are going to take place, Arthur.
Well, given the criminal code of Canada here and the way that it's set up, I'm fairly hopeful that they're going to lose this case, and I say that even full well knowing the influence that the Jewish lobby has within the court system here. There's no doubt, that they have a tremendous amount of influence there. But based on the data and based on the evidence, I'm fairly hopeful that they're going to have an extremely hard time proving their side of the case. I've already gone through a preliminary inquiry in the case, and it's now been set to go to trial next October 26th for a two-week trial period from October 26th of 2015 to November 6th of 2015. So that trial date has basically been set. But in the interim period, I'm also going to be filing a number of what we call pre-trial applications based on our charter provisions, which supposedly, give us the rights here in Canada to free expression and to freedom of the press and these types of things. And those applications are going to happen sometime either in the late spring or early summer. I should say too that, and this is pretty important in my case, is that up to this point in time, or at least since March of 2013, I have been without counsel, and I'm acting on my own behalf here, which places a bit of a, I shouldn't say a bit, but places a hell of a lot of extra emphasis on an onus on a person, when they have to deal with, with legal issues at this level on their own, and they're not a lawyer.
Sure.
I'm now in consultation with some legal counsel down in the Lower Mainland here in around Victoria, BC. And I will be getting legal help when it comes to filing these charter applications in the Supreme Court. And like I say, that'll probably be sometime after May of next year. But yes, it was very unfortunate. I had Canada's best free speech lawyer, world famous barrister by the name of Douglas Christie, who has defended all the major players here in Canada who've been charged with these various hate crimes over the last 25, 30 years. People like Jim Keegstra and Malcolm Ross, and probably the most famous of his clients was Ernst Zundel.
Ah, okay, there we go. Yeah, I remember that case where we linked up a very interesting documentary about that case a couple of months ago now, but that was very interesting. So it's the same person who were on defending him that's defending you there in the beginning. That's some good help you got there then.
Yes. Well, actually, Doug had contacted me way back in the earlier Section 13 case, and although he wasn't representing me formally, Anytime I had to write anything or do anything with the Human Rights Commission, I would send him the materials and so on, and he would give me advice and stuff like that. And then when I was arrested in 2012 under this criminal charge, then he was representing me from that point in 2012 until his unfortunate death in March of 2013. He suddenly succumbed to liver cancer, and that put an end to having him represent me.
Sorry to hear that. Yeah.
Yes, it was I'm the last of his free speech clients, and it would have been nice if he could have held out until he had freed me as well, but that was the way it went. And but I have legal representation now, and I'm basically in the process of trying to raise funding to pay for that next phase of the court actions here.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break in a little bit here, Arthur. Time just flew by here for the first segment, but we have much more to talk about and get into that I want to ask you about. I want to get into some of the politics in Canada right now as well, and as I mentioned, the Ottawa shooting case and all that kind of stuff right there. But give us some details about, obviously, give us your website so people know where to go, but also let us know if there's any way that people who are interested in supporting you and helping you, you know, legally or financially or what have you, that want to get in contact and maybe assist you in some way, how they can get in contact with you.
Yes, well, basically all my contacts and everything can be found right on the homepage of my website, which is radicalpress.com. Right on the menu, on the upper part of it, there's main headings, all the legal updates concerning my recent Section 319(2) charges and reference guide to the Section 13. There's also information on donating to the Arthur Totten Legal Defense Fund, and that's where anybody concerned with possibly helping out, financially, would just have to click on there. And of course, right on the homepage is a PayPal button as well, too. So that can also be used. But information is on the site there as far as if anybody wanted to send by mail, checks or things like that, or contact me in any way. All that information is right on my home page there.
All right, very good. The website again, radicalpress.com. And of course, check out then the Arthur Topham Legal Defense Fund. I'd say anyone that is concerned with freedom of speech, not only in Canada, but obviously primarily in Canada, do help out and, do try to assist. We need to try to assist each other in these kinds of scenarios and cases. And I mentioned that last time when we had Dave and Kim Dortch with us on the program as well, and I know that there was a lot of people helping out there, and I want to say thank you again to all of you who did that. And I think we have a similar case here, not in terms of what's going on, but in terms of how someone is being basically pushed into a corner. And I think it's really important that we do help each other out, so I hope we can bring some focus to this case and help Arthur out here. So please do considered it. The website is radicalpress.com, so take a look there. All right, well, Arthur, stay with us here. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll pick right up. We have much more to discuss. We'll return shortly.
Wanna be
As we pick up in the second hour, we continue to talk more about what the solution to many of the problems we've been talking about actually is and how to fight against the current government's desire to diminish our freedom of speech despite the long-standing tradition of the right to inquire, debate, and argue in the West. We also discussed the situation in Canada with the recent Ottawa shooting in mind and how they are seeking to capitalize on what very well might be another false flag. And of course, we have the media as accomplices in this as well. We continue to discuss if European Canadians are protected under these same hate speech laws as immigrants are. Later, we discuss white guilt and white privilege and how Arthur's case could lead to internet censorship down the line. Don't miss the second hour. We'll continue at redeyesmembers.com. Go there to sign up and tune in. And by the way, upcoming, we have Daniel Hammarberg, Jason Erb, Neil Kramer, Carlos Morales and Lawrence Eastman, to name a few. But we'll be right back. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us for much more.